Hey friends, welcome to today's episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. This is episode 166, and today I had the pleasure of interviewing Oregon native Greta Jarvis. She earned her Master of Science in Nutrition from the National University of Natural Medicine and holds certifications as an Integrative Health Coach and Intuitive Eating Counselor. The non-diet and weight-inclusive philosophies guide Greta's work as she guides clients toward discovering authentic health, peace, and freedom amidst a diet and weight-crazed world. She's an adjunct faculty member at the National University of Natural Medicine, social media expert for Evelyn Tripoli, the queen herself, the co-founder and author of Intuitive Eating, and Nicola Rinaldi, author of No Period, Now What? She's also the marketing and media manager for EDRD Pro. And for those of you who don't know, that is an organization that supports dietitians working in eating disorder specialties. When she's not working, Greta enjoys hiking, reading, traveling, practicing yoga, playing harp, how cool, and listening to country music. We had a phenomenal conversation just about the struggles of being a clinician in such a weight-focused area. And regardless of where you're at in your intuitive eating journey, we really dive a lot deeper into kind of the motivators, like why intuitive eating and this non-diet approach is so important, not just from an individual level, but really looking at the system and our culture. And some big takeaways that you're going to get from today's episode are how you can make a difference on, again, not just an individual change, but be part of the change, be part of this movement. And it's really exciting, especially just to hear the work that she is doing all the way on, you know, the other side of the country. Here I am in the Midwest. And so we had a lot of connections just of how, even though she's not a dietitian, she has so much work, so much background and knowledge and experience working with similar populations. And I think she has a really interesting lens that she works through. And I think you're going to get a lot of awesome tips. And if you haven't already, be sure to check us out on Instagram at FitFriendsHappyHour and subscribe so that you get the latest downloads every single Monday when you hit the subscribe button, and leave us a review. That's kind of like our tip jar. Let us know what you think, what you enjoy, what you want to hear more of, and how this is impacting, how this podcast, this weekly episodes are helping you to become a more positive, healthy, stronger you, both inside and out. All right, guys, on to the show. Welcome to Fit Friends Happy Hour, a podcast about all things nutrition, fitness, and life in your 20s and 30s, all from a non-diet lens. I'm your host, Katie Hake, and I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist and certified personal trainer. Join me here every week as I talk with interesting people and experts from all walks of life about their relationship with food, exercise, and their bodies. I am on a mission to help you redefine the word fit, to help you stop quantifying and start living. Learn to stop measuring your success by the scale and find your fears. So welcome to Fit Friends Happy Hour, Greta. We are so excited to have you. What a way to wrap up a week. Happy Friday.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here.
We've already been like chatting before this interview has even started, and I can already tell this is going to be full of good stuff. I said to you in the email, I was like, I have a lot of questions and we have a lot to unpack, so we're going to try to get it in 60 minutes, but let's just start by telling our audience about yourself. Like, what's your story?
Yeah, sounds great. So like Katie said, my name is Greta and I am coming at you from Portland, Oregon. So I have my certification as an integrative health coach. I'm also a certified intuitive eating counselor and have my Master of Science in Nutrition. So kind of an eclectic training background, but my main focus is walking alongside women who want to stop dieting, make peace with food and their bodies, and work for several other dietitians doing more social media support. Evelyn Tripoli, who wrote Intuitive Eating, is one of my clients. So I
she's our queen.
Work.
That's amazing.
She is.
Like, how she has to just probably be the most fun woman to work for or with.
Oh, she's right. Amazing. So getting to work with her. And then if you have any dietitians in your audience, EDRD Pro is another organization. And I'm their media and marketing manager. So it provides webinars, CEs, group supervision. So I wear many hats, but just listening to your podcast and kind of going through your bio, it seems like we have many similar interests and passions. So that is the bird's eye view introduction of who I am and what I do.
I love it. And so what really has me excited to chat today is how you have this background in natural medicine. And we're going to dive into that a little bit more. But so often we see when we're talking about intuitive eating and, you know, non-weight focused medicine, a lot of questions that tend to come up is, but what if I have this issue? Or what if I have this diagnosis? You know, how does that kind of all work together? And so today, what we're really going to talk a lot about is looking at the bigger picture, right? And like recognizing that females, humans, but, you know, especially us females, like we are complex and there is so much more to health than just the weight, right? So explain to us a little bit more about kind of your journey with natural medicine and what that looks like in your training.
That's a great question. I think in undergrad, I started to learn to look at health in different ways. And I went to a liberal arts college, so being able to look at systems and social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the biggest things that drew me to natural medicine. Is this is such a buzzword, but it seems more holistic, whole person. So for example, I was able to take not only medical nutrition therapy and nutritional biochemistry, but also farm to table, psychology of eating, food relationship coaching. So in that sense, I got what I was looking for, the more holistic view. But once I was in my master's program, it was interesting to see how that weight-centric focus and diet culture really pervades every corner. So yes, I was able to learn from a more whole person approach, but you can still absolutely see how diet culture has its little tentacles in really everything.
It really does. And it's so true. And I love that you mentioned kind of some of the different areas that you learned about. So for people listening, you know, Greta's not a dietitian, but you still have such a wealth of knowledge. And I think it's just so neat that you who's listening as a client, as a consumer, really like understand who's serving you information and recognize like she has such a unique background and it's science-based as well. And I think that's what it really comes down to and is so important. So before we go further, I'm curious, like how did you discover intuitive eating then? Like what was your path with that, right? Because it sounds like you graduated with your master's and then you're like, I get the nutrition piece, the natural medicine, functional medicine, but now I feel stuck.
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. And I don't actually remember how I heard of intuitive eating, but I read the book in undergrad. So it was before my master's.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Was that assigned or just you stumbled upon it? Like, I just love hearing this.
I just stumbled upon it. I honestly can't remember. And I wish I could because I'm asked this frequently. But I mean, maybe it was a podcast. I'm a big podcast person or just conversations floating around campus. Yeah. I really can't remember. But I think I read it maybe my junior year. And so that I think did inform my decision to go the natural medicine route as well, because again, intuitive eating has that broader focus mm-hmm. that takes more into account than just the food on your plate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. So what are some of the challenges that you see on an industry level? Do you work one-on-one with clients or tell us a little bit more about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do work with clients. I guess I'll start with your first question in terms of industry level. So natural medicine, it's offers a really beautiful opportunity for patients and clients. So just as an example, if you are to see a naturopathic physician, your appointment is usually an hour or an hour and a half. And the intake
so
forms,
not traditional. So right. Not traditional in the typical clinical hospital setting.
Right. And your intake form will have questions like, do you enjoy your job? How often do you take vacations? How much TV do you watch? Mm-hmm. So it really does ask about all those different corners of your life. And the weight piece still persists. So I remember sitting on the first day of, I don't remember what class, one of the more pathophysiology classes. Mm-hmm. And we start off with BMI. And so it's interesting that we do have all these social determinants of health woven into the curriculum in our paperwork and our training, but the starting place was still the same. And it's, if you look at research, that's how the research is written. So it's just baked into our systems and our policies and our research. And just because natural medicine, at least claims to try to break away from that, we have a long way to go in that field as well.
Could you educate us a little bit more about what are social determinants of health? Because I think that's such a key area, and especially in 2020, there's so much more discussion. So I really want to inform people, like, what does that mean? How is all of this really rooted in social justice and that social piece?
Yeah, I love that question. This is one of my favorite topics, and I'm always learning. So
aren't we all, right?
Yes. Yes, gosh. So social determinants of health really is just zooming out the lens. So for example, if I take my naturopathic training, there's a lot of focus on, okay, eating leafy greens or adding unicorn dust to your smoothie, just all of this really privileged, expensive, widely inaccessible, quote, superfoods. Mm-hmm. And great, I'm not going to slap anyone on the wrist for putting bee pollen on their muffin. Mm-hmm. However, if we're not looking at the broader picture, whether it be employment or do you have safe housing, or if you're in a marginalized body, are you dealing with microaggressions and discrimination on a day-to-day basis? So if you are a single mother, for example, and don't know if you're going to be able to make rent next month, well, you can eat the quote healthiest diet in the world, but that chronic stress is going to weigh, just overpower any of those nutritional changes you may make. So social determinants of health refer to that broader picture where social location, that's another way to look at it, of how much power and privilege you have in a given culture and how that has direct impacts on your health.
Thank you for explaining that. And I think that makes such a difference. And part of why we're here and having this conversation is letting people know that you may not have that same experience in a clinical setting or working with a professional, but in us as professionals, we need to be educated at least, right? If we are providing those services, like you said, and making those recommendations of like the bee pollen, or oh my gosh, we could think of so many examples of just specific just foods, but even like from a cultural standpoint as well, if we're not looking at all those other pictures, well, we're really doing our clients, our community a disservice.
Right. And what's interesting is in our field, there's so much focus on the individual. So if our client comes in and feels like they didn't stick to their diet, it's just heaping shame. And it's focused on, okay, let's brainstorm. How can we make sure this doesn't happen again? Rather than taking a step back and saying, what is your life looking like right now? And we're in unique places. I don't prescribe diets, but it's just an interesting interplay of in our field when we talk about social determinants of health. In the office, a lot of times that is left out, even if that provider has that lens, because it's very much focused on how can you change your health? How can you make these empowered decisions, willpower, discipline? I mean, all this language that's sort of coded to sound like empowerment, but it ends up perpetuating these systems that we need to break down.
Yeah, perpetuating. And I almost imagine it of like, it sends the client kind of just in this loop and like chasing their tail. And it's really not getting to the root of the actual issues, right? Which you and I know are so much deeper.
Right.
It's me, Katie. And in case you haven't already noticed, I kind of care about you getting results. Now, I'm not talking about results as far as body fat composition or the number on the scale, but I'm talking about implementing the things that you are learning here each and every week. Head on over to Facebook and just search Fit Friends Tribe to request to join our group. This is a free Facebook community where we talk about the podcast episodes each week, and I give you action steps on how to implement what it is that we talked about so that you're not just listening, learning, and absorbing information, but you're part of that top percent, that top 2% that actually takes action and changes their life. So facebook.com, search Fit Friends Tribe. I'm going to ask you a few questions to make sure you're not some weirdo from Antarctica, and we'll let you in. See you there. All right, back to the show.
Tell us, can somebody pursue health issues while also practicing intuitive eating? Because I think you probably have a different experience with this. So I would love to hear what your experience is like with clients that you see.
This is such a common question that comes up. And I think a lot of times if you search hashtag intuitive eating on Instagram, it's all rainbow sprinkles and donuts and ice cream, which is great.
Mm-hmm. And literally ice cream and sprinkles are
right. Quite literally. An exaggeration. Yeah. But I think there's this idea sort of in the broader culture that intuitive eating is just this screw it attitude toward food and your brain is checked out and you just go wild, mm-hmm. which that is true in a sense. However, your brain is also invited to join in on your eating decision. So one example that I've worked with a few clients with IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, for example, and they oftentimes come to me and say, listen, I've tried every diet in the book and I want to find relief from my symptoms. Of course they do. And I'm not going to sit there and just say, it doesn't matter, eat what you want, because that's not helpful and not realistic for everyone. So the approach I usually take is, what would it look like to approach these health issues with an open hand? So they're accustomed to, here's the list of foods that you cannot eat. Mm-hmm. And with me, I like to say, okay, what if we start with all the foods on the table? And it's more of a exploration to find what works for you. So I guess just approaching it from more of a posture of curiosity of if mm-hmm. you eat something and it aggravates your symptoms, that's information. It's not a personal failing. It's not a flaw. It's just information. Mm-hmm. And then moving forward, you can integrate that information into your eating decisions. Now, certainly if you have celiac disease, for example, and you cannot eat gluten, that's a hard line in the sand. That's not necessarily navigate with open curiosity territory.
Right, yeah.
But for many, I would say most health conditions, it's not one bite will make it or break it. So how can you explore how your unique body responds to different portions or timing or meals or combinations of food? The list could go on and on.
What a beautiful way to describe it. And I think that just is so hopeful for people listening, is that it's exploration. It's inviting. It's curiosity. It's not you have to do this, you have to do that in order to manage your disease. And it's, like you said, looking at all the other pieces of the puzzle.
Right. And that's another great point, is deconstructing those narratives we may have around certain foods. So for example, if you are terrified of sugar, when you have a slice of birthday cake, you may say, oh my goodness, I feel physically terrible. And that may be very much true. But what are the messages around that certain food, and how can we deconstruct them? Because that, again, that mind-body connection is so strong. So being able to, intuitive eating principle, I don't remember which, but make peace with food really lays the groundwork for you to be able to explore all different foods without having the dialogue of guilt and shame that oftentimes does translate into physical symptoms, because your body is listening.
Yeah. And if it's so, you know, muddled, or I don't know what the word is for it, if it's so tangled kind of in your brain, these thoughts and these beliefs, like you said, it's hard to identify, is that a physical feeling that I'm feeling, or is it, yes, it's physical, but is it driven by emotions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And being okay with that. I mean, food is profoundly emotional. Think of any holiday or celebration or culture. Food plays a huge role in that. And that's okay. Emotional eating isn't a negative thing. It's just what it means to be human.
Right. Absolutely. I was just talking to a new client this morning, and we were discussing just how there are people who it seems like it's as simple as eat this, not that, and that's mm-hmm. the end of it. And she felt hopeful in that, the sense of, I was like, there's a lot of people who don't feel like that, and you're right. Not alone if it is so tangled and overwhelming for you.
Yeah. And that's such an important piece of, you are not alone. I think in terms of food and body challenges, it's a very isolating experience. Mm-hmm. But trust me when I say, you are absolutely not alone. And I think it would be very, I don't want to use the word impossible, but I'm going to. Mm-hmm. I feel it would be impossible to find, I work with women, so that's my population, find a woman who's been raised in this culture and who hasn't struggled in some capacity with food or body image or just diet culture in every corner, because that's the water in which all of us are swimming.
Right. And you, Greta, you're in Portland. I'm in Indiana. Like, and we are having such similar experiences, right? And so I think it's nationwide. It's culturally wide. You know, in my intuitive eating counseling certification, we even had somebody from Ireland. So like,
wow,
this is global, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing that came to mind that I'm curious to hear your thoughts around this too, is just normalizing that to be human sometimes is to be uncomfortable. So when you read the media messages around food, it's eat this way and you'll be glowing and happy and energized for life. And just normalizing, hey, some days maybe you will be more bloated or tired, or you fill in the blank with whatever applies to your own life. So I think that's an important piece too, is there's not going to be the quote perfect diet where all of a sudden you have fairy dust just fueling you through life.
Right. If there was, none of us would be here, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So being able to say sometimes your stomach might hurt, and that it doesn't always have to be an interrogation of, oh gosh, what did I eat or what did I not eat? No, it's just to be able to kind of roll with the punches that come with life. And again, that open hand imagery I find is very helpful for people.
Yeah, recognize that it doesn't have to bear the weight of all these other thoughts just because you're feeling bloated. This reminded me of a story not too long ago. I actually had a friend reach out to me, and he was saying, you know, oh my gosh, Katie, like, I just can't figure it out. I get so bloated and gassy when I eat. It was a bunch of vegetables. And so he told me like how many vegetables he was eating, right? Because he's kind of in that clean eating lifestyle. And I said, you know, friend, it's because you ate 3 cups of Brussels sprouts. Like that's normal. And so we had a great dialogue about just that is normal human bodily functions.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling all those different things.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that so interesting that sometimes the solution is to eat fewer vegetables,
which
isn't what you're going to hear in public health messaging.
Absolutely not. So let's talk about what are some of the challenges that you see. We touched on this a little bit, but that you see in other people kind of in your line of work with the integrative medicine that makes your job challenging. Like, I'm guessing that clients come to you because they have issues that they've tried the traditional path. What has led them to you, which has made it so challenging?
Yeah. I would say my typical client is normally someone who says, hey, I've been dieting since I was a teenager. I'm so sick of it, but I don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that challenge relates directly to the naturopathic or integrative medicine industry per se. I think mm-hmm. I see it more as just that cultural level. And the challenge, we sort of talked about this before, is that breaking down all the messages we've learned about food and body since we could even absorb messages from the world is not an easy task. And you may read intuitive eating or listen to your podcast, for example, and be very excited about, okay, I'm not going to diet anymore. But it's like learning a second language or a new skill where it's not, you can understand it in your head, but the only way to really embody it is just, you gotta walk the walk. You have to practice. And it's not just this overnight fix. So with diet culture, for example, sometimes that feels much safer and more comfortable because, great, here's your exact list of what you can eat, what you can't. But intuitive eating, we are just burning the list. There is no list.
Yes, we're burning the list. We're burning the scales.
Right. Yeah. Right, which is a beautiful thing, but also scary because I can't sit with a client and say, this is how many days it will take. This is what you should be eating, because it absolutely depends on each person. And everyone has different stumbling blocks and victories and preferences and needs. And it's just not a black and white process.
Yeah, it's black and white, and it's helping people to see the gray. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you that. What are some of the things that you do to help your clients not just see the gray, but understand the gray? And like you said, it's one thing to understand it, but to embody it. So how do you really help people to feel that fear and embody kind of intuitive eating and living in the gray?
It definitely depends on the client, but I think one strategy that I think can be a helpful one is just taking it a meal at a time or a day at a time. And sometimes a client will say, oh, wow, this is so overwhelming. I don't think I can do it. So we'll say, okay, what if just as an experiment for your next meal or your next snack even, you just try to erase all those external messages of what is a quote good food or bad food and just really tune in to what would be satisfying right now. So mm-hmm. I think breaking it down into baby steps can be much more accessible for people because it's like training wheels on a bike. You're not just going to rip them off all at once. It's normally a process. So that's something that can be really helpful is just breaking it down day by day. And I'm a huge podcast fan. So I always, if they're a podcast fan, I think that can be really helpful to have some alternative narrative, because if you are just walking around in the world, look at the magazines, look at the ads, look at the television, it's all going to be weight focused and diet focused. So I think it is important to have some other source that's pushing back against those messages.
Mm-hmm. We don't realize, like you said, if we have been exposed to it from a young age, we don't realize how many of those thoughts are so deeply ingrained in how we just go about our day, whether it's consuming media, whether it's walking down the street. We don't realize how much those messages just become the norm and just we absorb them.
Right. I have so many clients come back and say, I'm shocked. I had no idea. But now when you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And it's everywhere. It's with family, friends, medicine, media. I challenge you to find an area where this does not exist. In even subtle forms, it shows up really everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to talking about the social determinants of health. And if you have a client, or let's say you have somebody who is experiencing one of those, I guess you could say, barriers, how can somebody who's in a situation where they are struggling on a deeper level, how can they embrace intuitive eating? Or how can they, maybe they're listening and they're thinking, I'll never be able to even get close to having peace with food because I struggle with my finances, my body, Trump, right? All these other things. Do you have any tips for that person? Sorry, that was a really long, loaded question.
Yeah, I wish I could give you a straightforward answer here. For me, I think just naming that situation and normalizing it and holding space for it and really affirming that this is not a personal failing. That's the simplest first step. I think just a lot of people don't even realize that there are some things outside of our control, because that's not how diet culture is making billions of dollars a year. But I also think just on a personal level, how am I engaging in these broader systems and how can you bring about change on a social level that will address these deeper issues? Because a lot of these examples we brought up, it's not something we can deconstruct in a one-on-one session, for example. Mm-hmm. So I wish there was a better answer.
Can you think of an example to kind of explain that a little more?
Yeah. So one example when we're talking about body image is a person's body absolutely informs the way in which they move through the world, the way in which they're treated. So it's very different for me as a thin white woman to do body image work than it would be for someone in a larger body. So I'm always extraordinarily aware of that in session of it's not always hashtag love your body. It's much deeper, harder work for someone who's continually getting very real, cruel messages from the world that their body is not okay. Or the built environment, you look at airplane seats or theater seats, they aren't accessible to all bodies. Mm-hmm. So that, I think with my clients, that's the piece that shows up most frequently is how do we build body image resilience and a strong sense of self when there's an entire chorus of culture that is pushing back on that. Mm-hmm. And there is, again, there's not an easy answer. That I think is where the deeper work comes with the clients of having conversations, really looking at what their day-to-day life looks like and how can we strengthen that muscle of self-worth, but it's going to be a completely different conversation if you do have a marginalized identity in some way.
That's heavy, but it's also, I think it's so important, and it's so important that we're having this conversation. I just had like a flashback when you were talking. One of my first roles as a dietitian was working in bariatrics in a weight loss, you know, weight loss program. And I was blessed with amazing coworkers, amazing program. But just like you said, I was not educated about this in my training. Like you said, I'm a, you know, fairly thin white woman trying to counsel and educate somebody who has been in a larger body their entire life to the point where they feel like they have to surgically cut out their stomach in order to fit in this world. And it's, you know, let's say somebody's listening and they're like, I'm not a clinician. I'm just Sally walking down the street. What are things that they can do to help, right? Because it's systemic. We all have a place in this world of what we have to do and what we can do to break down some of these changes.
Yeah. I think one thing I'll just add to is I'm always very clear, as you were saying, is the client is the expert of their experience and of their body. So I perhaps have some more professional training and tools, but that will never override their lived experience. And I'm always very intentional. Oh, what books am I reading? Whose voices am I listening to? And being open to messing up, because we're going to. There are some things I just don't see. So that's a piece I think is important, whether you're a clinician or not, is take stock of the authors and bloggers and your social media and whose voices and whose experiences. Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but like, let's nail that one home. Is who is on your social media feed? Like, are you just following thin white women? Like, what does your feed look diverse? Because we don't realize how the lack of diversity affects how we portray others and how we show up in the world.
Yes. And being able to retrain your brain. That's an amazing part of this process of social media. I have mixed feelings. However, being able to...
Yeah, you're the social media expert. You tell us, like, what do we do?
Oh, goodness. Yes, just see who you follow and make sure it's all different ages and genders and body sizes and races, and being able to normalize all sorts of different types of bodies. So that's something anyone in social media can do. And another piece I would say is just be willing to speak up when you see, of course, if you have the bandwidth, we all need to take care of yourself. But if someone says a body shaming joke, or if your friends are bringing up what parts of their body they don't like, whatever it is, which now that you know it's there, you'll be able to see it, to be, what would it look like to offer a different perspective or speak up? And you will have to discern what makes the most sense for that relationship, for that conversation. But I think using questions are a good approach of just
inserting what kind of questions did you ask? Holidays will be here before you know it. Let's like prepare people with some tools in their toolbox of like when Aunt Sally is talking. I don't know why I keep thinking of Sally.
Poor Sally.
I know, poor Sally, and nothing against you, but when they're making these comments, like what questions can we ask?
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on the context. So it may just be a boundary that you need to set. If Aunt Sally keeps commenting on your food or your body, sometimes good old boundaries are the place to start. But one is just like, what do you mean by that? And being able to unpack these assumptions that are taken for, quote, truth, such as smaller bodies are better bodies or healthier bodies, or this is what healthy eating looks like. So I think asking that question can facilitate a discussion. And again, depends on the person, you know, your relationship. So read the room as well.
Use your emotional intelligence.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But I think just pausing to ask, what or where did you learn that? Or what if this was also true? I think it can be tempting to just come out swinging when you see diet culture for what it is, and just to be very angry. And there's a place for that, absolutely. Use that anger to fuel your work and your healing. But people aren't going to change if you come bopping them over the head. I think it comes slowly. It comes with respectful dialogue. So I find that questions are a helpful way to do that, because it's you asking for more insight from them rather than coming at them saying how wrong and oppressive that comment was.
Right. It's not productive. And mm-hmm. I think I heard this maybe from Evelyn Tribbley about what we need to do as just humans is call each other in instead of calling people out and saying, this is wrong. You know, you shouldn't say this or do this. But like you said, facilitating a discussion that we can just talk and learn from each other and learn from each other's experiences. And then is when we can actually make change.
Right. I love that. Calling each other in. I think that is Evelyn. And just noticing, where do you have influence? It could be at your school, at your church, in your friend group, at your gym. So just really taking mm-hmm. stock of which systems, which people groups do I have a voice, and how can I use it for good?
mm-hmm. That was one thing my good friend and I, Lauren, she actually used to do the podcast, but she's still in the cover art. Lauren, we miss you. But
I had her
on an episode and we talked about, I mean, we're best friends about, okay, it feels really overwhelming and daunting to take on all of this just in general. But
oh yes,
by starting with those conversations, just with one, maybe even just one friend that you feel comfortable with opening up.
Right.
Then allows, or go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, even in my program, my master's program was quite small. So certainly I did not change the program in any huge systemic way, but being able to identify the professors whom I could trust in having conversations. So if we had a weight loss assignment, I would go in and say, I don't feel comfortable with this. This is not I practice.
You're amazing. I applaud you for that, because that takes courage. It really does.
Yeah. It started with that small conversation and her saying, absolutely, do the assignment how you feel comfortable. And then that turned into broader classroom discussions. And now some of my friends who have been in the program currently say, now that professor assigned some different readings. So it can be very teeny changes like that, where now the classmates coming after me are getting to read these different perspectives and just having that seed planted. And that just came from a trusted conversation with a professor who I felt would be open to it.
You read my brain and it gave me goosebumps, but I think it really is all about planting a seed
mm-hmm.
and recognizing that slow and steady with all of this, right? When it comes to making those changes towards, you know, this non-diet lens,
yeah,
doable, but it takes patience. And
oh, for sure. It's a process. Mm-hmm. There's a great imagery I love if you think of one of those chains that have the links in it. Mm-hmm. And just imagine each conversation is adding a link. So very rarely will you be that final link where the light bulb goes off and you see that immediate change. But every conversation, every question, every podcast episode is absolutely a link. And that matters. And we need all hands on deck. This is a big task.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I love that link. I can visualize it. So, and maybe that's why we can't remember the moment that we learned about intuitive eating, because it was and is just this culmination of conversations and dialogue and listening and learning and reading and doing the work.
Right. Because we go through our training and we don't learn this. So this is, mm-hmm. which I find powerful too, is we're trained in these traditional frameworks and then realizing there's something off here. This isn't working. So having to do that additional work and interrogation and questioning is really powerful. I think it makes this work just all the more gratifying, because you've done both sides and it's a learning process. Mm-hmm. We stumble our way through it. Sure, I know I've made mistakes, but it's just being able to be open to continually learning. Where again, with that dominant framework is you are the expert in a capital E, and there's very little room for growth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Oh my goodness. If I just think back, if I were to have stopped learning when I couldn't figure out really what intuitive eating is, but I couldn't explain it. Working mm-hmm. with clients, I had more than one client walk out crying because I thought it was being helpful, but really mm-hmm. I just couldn't explain it. But like you said, yeah. I mean, that's how we learn. That's how we grow in whatever area that we're going through. This is, you have to just fail forward. You have to take each, each eating opportunity, each learning opportunity is just that. It's an opportunity. It's experience to learn and move forward.
Yes, I love that. Fail forward. That's life, isn't it?
Life in 2020, that's for sure.
Oh, yes. What a time to be alive.
Well, this has been so wonderful. So we have a few more questions as we wrap up our time, but what are some tips? And again, we talked about this a little bit, but if you had to give like one or two final tips of for someone who wants to pursue their health issues from a non-diet lens, I pulled something from your blog that just really spoke to me about, you know, for example, refusing to participate in body talk is actually a courageous and healing act. So what are some of your big takeaways from that?
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, so from the blog or from the pursuing health?
Let's do both. Let's start with the blog.
Okay, great. Yeah, that piece was actually inspired by, it was my orientation for my master's program. And I was sitting in the audience with all my new classmates and just hearing the different professors speak. And there were a couple of comments that just really were upsetting to hear. So I'll give you two mm-hmm. examples. And I unpack them in the blog post. Is one, she was saying, "Now, I'm a runner, but I know I don't look like it, but I just had a baby, so cut me some slack." And everyone kind of does that.
Which we hear
laugh.
All the time. We hear stuff all the time.
Yeah. All the time. It sounds a little benign if you're not listening through that lens. But in my mind, I thought, what if I don't have kids, but picturing my daughter or even a son or whoever sitting there, what messages are they picking up? There's several. It's okay, a runner's body looks a certain way, and the postpartum body is not as desirable. I mean, there's so many underlying messages there. Mm. And then the other one, she was talking about, I think it was dandelion tea. And she said, it's a diuretic, so great way to take off that water weight, ladies. And again, with the knowing laughter. And I was just sitting there, like, I'm so upset. There's constantly these messages.
My blood is boiling over here in the corner. You're like, what's this what... problem?
Right? That's when I do my best writing. I was pissed. But just again, okay, what's a woman's purpose? Smaller is better, smaller, smaller. Always thinking about what this food will do to my body. So that was the genesis of that blog post of just really unpacking how this is everywhere. And what if no one laughed, for example, and that joke fell flat? Or if it's a smaller conversation and someone pushed back against it. And it's hard. It's so hard because it's just this culturally sanctioned form of camaraderie, especially among women, to mm-hmm. body bash and talk about your diet. So I really think culture is every single one of us. So if everyone were to stand mm-hmm. up and not participate in that, it would have this ripple effect across culture and generation. So that's how I'm framing not talking about food or body as a courageous and healing act.
So powerful. So powerful. Mm-hmm. So again, like you said, reading your audience and the situation and the relationship, you could use either one of those strategies depending on where you're at. And like you said, the bandwidth, both can be equally powerful of inviting somebody into a conversation or just not engaging and saying, no, I'm not going to bring attention to this. I'm not going to laugh at your joke or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, in that situation, there was myself and 100 other students. So I didn't stand up and yell.
Your silence wasn't as,
as powerful in that moment. But I think it just really fueled me to realize, yes, I do want to be engaged in these conversations and sort of paving the path to speak with my professors, speak with my classmates, and just being able to challenge those mentalities in other ways. Because I don't think if I stood up and yelled, it would have the desired effect.
Again, knowing your audience, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Either way, that's so powerful. So let's go back to that last question then. What are some takeaway tips that you have for somebody who wants to pursue their health or their health issues from this non-diet lens?
Right. So let's take that question just from the general person who doesn't have a specific diagnosis, and just health is sort of this nebulous concept. What does it really mean? But we hear all the time, I want to take care of my health, which is great. I'm all about that. Double thumbs up. Mm-hmm. I think for me, the biggest tip is paying attention to your mind as well as your body and breaking down that binary black or white thinking. So what does health mean to someone and what does it signify? So a lot of times we think chasing health will bring happiness, success, whatever it is, and just really breaking down, where did we receive those messages? Is it true? And I think being able to ask those questions really allows us to connect back to ourselves rather than carrying along all this cultural baggage. So there's nothing wrong with vegetables. I'm a big fan. But what would it look like to play around with how you serve them? So adding butter or some fun spices and being okay with having a cupcake with your kale salad. I think health carries a lot of black and white thinking. So that's, it's again, on brand. There's no black and white answer here, but I really think exploring our assumptions and getting away from all or nothing is the secret sauce in this arena.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would agree with that 100%. That's so powerful. So we have to finish with a rapid fire because it's my favorite thing to do. We should have done this at the beginning, but we were already warmed up. So tell us a favorite podcast right now. I don't know about you, but I will binge like a bunch. I'll listen to one person for a while and then I'll be stuck on another and it goes all over. So what's your favorite podcast right now?
Okay. Right now, if you look at my queue, it alternates the Evolving Faith podcast and then Españolistos, which is in Spanish. I'm working on practicing Spanish. So every other episode is either Evolving Faith or Españolistos.
Love it. Look at you, even have like the accent a little bit.
Oh, gracias.
What do they call it? No, there's a word for it. It's like not the twang. That's like the Southern thing. I don't remember.
Great question.
I don't have an answer. I think Spanish 5 is as far as I got. I got pretty far, but
Wow, claro. Entonces, tenemos que practicar.
Meanwhile, I don't know. It's been too long. I need to go back to it. So that's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Your favorite beverage?
Oh, my goodness. Coffee and water? That's kind of boring, but yep,
cheers.
There we go.
Cheers to that.
Oh, jinx.
Sweet or salty?
Probably sweet.
That's hard. That's a hard one. Both.
It is hard. Yeah. you're really asking the hard hitting questions here.
And then last question, what is the best thing that has happened to you this week?
Oh, I love that question. This podcast is a highlight. Oh, I think it's, I heart. So like we said, I'm in Portland, Oregon, and we are doubly quarantined because of the wildfires. So it's been sort of a rough week of just the air quality is terrible. So this was a really fun little bright spot that broke the normal routine and good conversation. So you're my highlight, Katie. Oh,
I did not tell Greta to say that. That it did not
checks
pay,
in the mail, I hope.
Pay
right?
her for that. Like, that is awesome. So thank you again so much for being here. I think such a wealth of knowledge and just so many golden nuggets in today's episode. I encourage anybody who's listening to like go back with a notebook, take some notes, write things down, because again, repetition and just each time we listen and we explore intuitive eating and this whole world of amazingness, we learn something different, not just about it, but about ourselves. So if our audience, or I should say when our audience wants to find you, what's the best place to find you? Where do you hang out?
I would say find me at my website. It's www.nutritionforgood.net. So .net, not .com. And you'll find all my contact info there. I'm not the most active on social media. So I would say website. You can find Instagram and all that, but I probably haven't posted in years. But I'm still there. I still exist. So
like you can find me, but you won't find much. So right. We will be sure to link to your website and your blog and all that good stuff in the show notes. And again, thank you so much. It's such a joy.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. If you liked this episode, don't forget to share it with a friend. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Fit Friends Happy Hour. Talk to you next time.